Welcome to the quantum gravity course. I'll start by explaining what this course is and is not about. The name might be a bit misleading. I posted this morning a description on the portal, so you can also review it there. If you're not part of PSI, maybe drop me an email so that I can know who you are, and especially if you need to validate this, we need to, well, it's probably, I don't think it's late, but we would have to know if you need a validation. How many of you have done Kevin's and Giuseppe's class on symplectic geometry and all of those things? Who didn't? Maybe it's easier. One, two, three. Okay. Good. So I think for most of you, then, the beginning will be a bit smoother than last year when nobody had seen it. So that hopefully it helps. So because the first point that I will touch on is a formulation of mechanics in terms of giving a geometric formulation of mechanics and of field theory later on in terms of what is called symplectic geometry. So for most of you, this will be a quick review. For the others, a fast introduction. From that, we will build on this to introduce what is often called the covariant phase space method. This is, in a sense, a generalization of these two field theories, in a sense that we will make clear. And this allows us to give an in-depth study of the symmetries of general relativity. Which we will see they are more involved than one might think at first. And in particular, we will build up to explaining why general covariance is a powerful physical principle. So it's not just, it's more than just being able to rename coordinates as we like. And so this, in fact, allows us to discuss a theorem that derives GR from its symmetries. Oops. And we will use this to discuss why quantizing general relativity is so hard, is much harder than, I will try to argue based on this point, why quantizing GR is actually much harder than quantizing other theories. We will also use the covariant phase space method to review a famous result by Wald. Well, a famous construction by Wald, which is Wald's entropy, black hole entropy, well, black hole mechanics, let's say like this, where he, in particular, discusses black hole entropy in terms of neutral charges, so in terms starting from the symmetries of the theory. And the reason why I'm insisting so much on this covariant phase space is because it's in fact a quite powerful tool that is used these days in lots of fields, not just quantum gravity. Well, especially in GR-related fields like quantum gravity, holography, thermodynamics, in like black hole mechanics, and so on. So it's kind of a unifying tool that is useful to know in all these contexts. And it's not attached to any preferred theory of quantum gravity or anything like that. It's a more general umbrella. Then once we've understood the covariant phase space and applied it to different situations, I will go from the covariant phase space, bring it down to the canonical phase space. And with these, I will discuss GR constraint algebra, which is the starting point for canonical approaches to quantization of general relativity. And here, these two points, well, I should have probably put these two points over there, but. And finally, from here, time allowing, I will discuss a little bit about the issues of quantizing this. And so the Wheeler-DeWitt equation and various approaches. So for example, in a tutorial, we will look at Aschdecker variables for general relativity. Which are the starting point of the loop quantization, but in that context are just a sleek way to write the constraint algebra. They give us a sleek way to write the constraint algebra in a much simpler form than usual, than ADM variables, for example. Okay, so this is the plan. As you see, we will not really touch upon the quantization, but what I hope to do here is to build up all the tools that will allow you to read about canonical approaches to quantum gravity and understand what is actually going on and what the difficulties are. So in a sense, I'm trying to rephrase in a modern language, which is this covariant phase space method, results that have been found between the 50s and 80s by the quantum GR community or quantum gravity community, by people who were trying to quantize general relativity. So it's all the groundwork that is usually skipped. I'm trying to fit it into this course. Any questions before we jump into symplectic geometry and so on? Okay. So starting from the basic, from the beginning, let's start with the deduction principle. So as you all know, we have the action principle is determined by some Lagrangian function, which is a function of some generalized coordinate and their velocities. I will not include an explicit time dependence ever. So for me, a Lagrangian is always a function of q and q dot. Now, So the point here is that we study this the space of histories that take us from some initial value of q at some time t initial to some final value of q at some time t final. And the claim is that the extremality of the action with respect to changes in the trajectory, in the history, determine the physical path. So the idea is here to explore all possible Neighbourian path, and the physical one is the one for which the variation of the action at the physical path Q naught is zero. So as you all know, this can be written as like this, delta q plus a boundary term, which is dl over q dot delta q initial. So to make sense of these variational principle, we have to keep fixed the two extremes of these trajectories, of these families of trajectories. So this object is actually zero, and we are left with the Euler-Lagrange equation over here that needs to be satisfied. So the reason why I went through these details is to emphasize that here in this boundary term that we're throwing away because we're using the action principle at fixed initial and final boundary conditions, there appears this quantity, which is the canonical momentum p. So maybe that. Yeah?
So when we talk about action functionals, sometimes we just consider the single solution that minimizes the action in that particular sense. Is there any way to think about multiple different local minimas of the action functional? Because these things, they probably don't matter for the classical equations of motion, but when you put them, when you integrate
them. There are you could have different vacuas in, like in the quantum theory, you would talk about different vacuas. So you have different classical backgrounds in which you can do perturbation theory, if that. And I'm not sure this is a theorem or anything, but I would say different vacuas usually correspond to different, well, they're truly different sectors of the theories to a large extent. The perturbative theory on top of them are, do not talk to each other. They're a different irreducible representation of the algebra. I'm not completely sure that in all cases they can be related to the vacua, different vacua in this sense, but or not. But that's also if you remember Ruth's course, she discussed about the vacuum decay, and so that was in this sense, in this precise sense of different minima. They are local minima, and there is a true minimum and a metastable minimum, and you can have a tunneling between the two. Okay. So, but the reason I was mostly interested in going through this standard thing is to extract this P, which allows me to introduce the Hamiltonian. So I know I'm going slow, but I will need all these quantities later, so. It's helpful to build up to them. So here we can define P as this is the canonical momentum. And the way to read this equation is as an implicit equation for Q dot in terms of the left-hand side P and Q, as they appear there. And so once we do this, we can define H, the Hamiltonian, as PQ dot minus LQQ dot, where every time there is a Q dot appearing, what I really mean is this expression deduced from that. Now the equation of motion in these variables are minus the partial derivative of H, the Hamiltonian, by Q, and Q dot is the partial derivative of H by P. Now, I want to interpret this first order equation geometrically on the space of P's and Q's. So this space is what I call the phase space P. So I have Q's and P's over there. And so Q dot and P dot are small variation in Q and P. So I want to interpret these as a vector. So given a point in field space, in phase space, I have the vector that I call XH, which has components dh over dp and dA and minus dh over dq. And so the way I want to read this is as d over dt of q and p is equal to xh, like that. So this now is a vector field on p, or better, these are its components, but as usual, I'm mixing them up, which is a sort of velocity in phase space, and is called the Hamiltonian vector field. Phase space, and is the Hamiltonian vector field. So, and this explains why the Hamiltonian formulation is, in a sense, much nicer than the Lagrangian one. And it is because, given the Hamiltonian vector field at each point in phase space, the trajectory of the system is just an integral curve of this vector field. So in that sense, we can geometrically solve the dynamics once we know the Hamiltonian, because the Hamiltonian gives us the vector field, and the time evolution is just the integral curves of this vector field over phase space. So this is what we gain by going to a first order formulation. This was not possible in the Lagrangian formulation, which had second order differential equations. So something I haven't said is that there I'm assuming that the Lagrangian is quadratic in the velocities, as usual.
These two are always equivalent, or there are some conditions?
If it's quadratic in the velocities, they are equivalent. Well, you need this relationship to be invertible.
Yeah.
So it's like the mass should be an invertible matrix in a sense. The quadratic form entering the Lagrangian should be invertible. Okay, so now going a step farther in this geometrization, we introduce Poisson brackets. Which you're also familiar with. So these are this is a map between that takes two functions, f and g, and sends it to a new function on phase space, which is the bracket fg. So in let's say we are in this situation with p described by coordinates p's and q's, then this bracket is nothing else than, and here I might get the sign wrong, but it's not too important in the following. So I'm not completely sure my conventions with the signs are fully consistent. But it's not too big of a deal. Okay, and now we see that once we introduce this object, we can write xh as, let's see if this makes sense. So this is what? This is the sum over I of dh dpe ddq I minus dh over dqi d over dpi. Let's see if my conventions are correct. So this is the component in Q, which is the hdp, and the other one is minus. So far, so good. So there is, again, this is all, you all know this, but let's now move to to symplectic geometry very quickly, and try to, what I'm trying to do here is to take this Poisson bracket, which is geometrically a bit of a weird object. We will see how to interpret it geometrically in terms of a bivector field. But for now, it's just something that eats function and spits out a different function. So I want to give a more geometrical meaning to this guy. So to do this, I will go through a bit of a detour and come back to this at the end. Symplectic geometry. So we have, so here, the definition of a symplectic manifold is the following. Let P be 2n dimensional. And omega is a two-form on P. P is my phase space. I will not put coordinates on it. I'm working abstractly. But the interpretation of P is my phase space. And now I take a two-form with the following two properties. Omega is non-degenerate. And two, omega is closed. By closed, I mean that d omega is 0. And this is what defines the symplectic manifold. Well, omega is then a symplectic form. And P with omega together is the symplectic manifold. So these non-degenerate and closed should be imprinted in your memory for the next 5 weeks at least. So now let's look at what these two conditions actually mean. So non-degeneracy. So what is a two-form? A two-form is something that in coordinates grids like this. So z is a coordinate on phase space. You see, I'm not distinguishing between q's and p's. I'm calling them all z. And now the point is that the non-degeneracy condition is that this is invertible at all z as a 2n by 2n skew symmetric matrix. So if this is invertible, I call omega non-degenerate. Now, there is a nicer way to do this, which doesn't require introducing coordinates, which is the following. I want to think of omega as a map that takes a vector over my phase space to a covector over phase space. So how does this work? It takes a point in the tangent bundle is given by a point on the manifold and a vector at the tangent space and maps it to a covector. And how is the covector defined? Is defined as the contraction of my two form with my vector evaluated at that point in phase space. So now this is an element of the cotangent bundle. You will agree? And the non-degeneracy of omega if and only if this map, omega flat, it's marked with a flat because it takes something with upper indices to something with lower indices. That's the idea. omega flat is injective. And once it's injective, one can prove that it's also surjective and therefore bijective. So it's quite, then if this map is bijective, it's clear that it's the same thing as asking that this is invertible. But at least this is a bit nicer, because if you are in field theory, our phase space will be an infinite dimensional manifold. So talking about invertibility of infinite dimensional matrices is not a nice thing. Whereas this injectivity generalizes straight, you just require the same thing, essentially. It's a bit weaker, because it doesn't mean that it's a bijection anymore. This works in finite dimension. In finite dimension only. But this formulation of the non-degeneracy condition generalizes to field theory. Questions about this? Yeah?
Oh, yeah, sorry. I missed it while you were saying injective implies surjective.
It's because it's Q-symmetric.
Okay.
So that is what helps you. Okay. Now, and closed means closed. So why we need to require closed will be clear later. Yes.
Why does injective imply surjective?
So it works because we are in finite dimensions and the matrix is antisymmetric. So it's a lemma.
Isn't it just a consequence of the rank nullity theorem?
Probably.
And then you don't even need skew symmetry?
Hmm?
You don't even need skew symmetry? I mean, if you are like in two, you have a map between two spaces. The dimension of the kernel plus the dimension of the image.
Because in finite dimensions, your isomorphic.
Yes.
Dimension.
Yes. Yeah, sorry. Yes, you're right. Okay. Okay, another small definition that we will not use that much, but is nice to know, is that of the Liouville form. We define it as 1 over n factorial of the product of omega with itself n times. So we see that this is a top form on phase space. So if you want, this is a volume form on your phase space. And Liouville theorem, we will see it in a few minutes. The Liouville theorem from statistical mechanics has a very nice formulation in this context, which is extremely simple, in fact. So this is a volume form on P. And yet another definition. Today is the first day, so there are lots of those. Is that of symplectic potential. So a one form on phase space such that d theta, omega equal d theta is symplectic, is called a symplectic potential. It's a bit like we have a gauge potential and a curvature. This is the same thing. This is like a potential for a curvature. In fact, in a precise sense that you probably saw, but I will not. You might have seen it if you did geometric quantization, but I will not go there. Yeah.
The existence of theta is only because we are in R2n.
I'm not saying it exists. If this is satisfied, I call it a symplectic potential. existence not guaranteed unless the cohomology of P is trivial. The first cohomology of P is trivial. So since it's closed, you see this is automatically closed. So knowing a theta allows to trivialize the second condition, which is in a sense the more complicated one. But and in fact, if you want the topology of phase space is trivial, you know that every close by the Poincaré lemma, every closed form is actually exact. So this is possible if the first cohomology of P is zero. But otherwise, you can have this locally, as we will see in a second. So the problem is to have a theta globally, but usually locally you have it. And as we saw, in fact, well, that's where I'm going, that usually if you start from a Lagrangian, you always have a theta because you're dealing with a cotangent bundle.
Excuse me.
Yes.
P is just any manifold, or in order to call it a phase space, it should have some condition.
To call it a phase space? I would say that I'm using interchangeably phase space and symplectic manifold. So a manifold equipped with such an omega, I would call it a phase space. Okay. And the fact is, this omega, once you have this omega, you have a Poisson bracket, as I will say in a few minutes. So if you think of a phase space as a space with a Poisson bracket, this is equivalent. In fact, it's a bit stronger than that. But we will get there. So this important theorem states that a cotangent bundle is canonically symplectic. And canonically here means that it has its own God-given symplectic form. So let's start from the cotangent bundle at a certain point of the manifold. This is a vector space with basis dqi. Right? Now, on this vector space, peak coordinate, let's say that the pi are coordinates on tq star at q, at little q, in this basis. So what does this mean? If I have an alpha, which is a covector at this point in my cotangent bundle, it means that I can always write alpha as some values of these pi's times dqi. Now, so this is point one. Point two is the observation that now pi qi is a basis of t star q, because this tells me which cotangent space I'm picking, and this tells me which points in the cotangent fiber I'm picking. So now we have, sorry, not the basis. This is I meant coordinates. Sorry. So Q determines the base, and pi determines the fiber. And now with these, I can define my the one form pi dqi. So this is a form at p and q. So notice, importantly, that here the p's had specific values determined by which alpha I was picking, whereas here p is the generic coordinate on p. So here p's and q's are coordinates on p, and this is a one form on p. Of course, it's a very special one form. It's not a generic one form, and this one form is called the canonical, or maybe sometimes tautological, one form. And from these, I can define d theta, which takes this nice form over here. And this is symplectic. It's clearly non-degenerate, because let's look at it in 2D. If n equal 1, this is just, it's just a matrix of this form, omega, so this is invertible. If I have n equal 2, it's just, there are just blocks like these that repeat themselves for each I. And it's closed because it comes from a theta. Now, I've defined these using coordinates, but there is an abstract definition that can be given that doesn't use coordinates, so shows that this is a global two-form on the entire phase space. Doesn't matter which kind of topology Q has, you can always do this. Yes?
Can you explain again what are the P's in the first form?
So these P's?
Yeah.
So here, the situation is the following. I have some manifold Q. And at some point of Q, I'm looking at the cotangent space. Now, drawing cotangent spaces is not the easiest, so I will just draw a tangent space. And the blue is always not the best color. And tangent spaces are vector spaces. So in a vector space, you have a basis, and the point in the space is determined by some coordinates, which are the coefficients of the point in that base. So that was those p's are. So q is a point here, and p fixes. So this is what I call alpha, is a point in this space, is a vector in my cotangent space. And its coordinates in this specific base are given by the p's. Does that help? So if I choose.
It does not have any relationship yet with the p's.
It does, but I will get there. I'll get there in a second. So here, if you choose coordinates on q, you have a grid like that. And if you follow the grid in the tangent space, in the cotangent space, this is what is giving you the local basis. And in that specific basis, you have these p's. So this is a coordinate-dependent construction, of course. But one can show that which coordinates you pick doesn't really matter when you define theta. Like, the dependence on the choice of coordinates washes out. So what is the relationship between these p's and the canonical p's over there? Well, I think it will get clear when we write the dynamics, but they are the same. So when you have this action principle, you see I drew the action principle just using the q coordinates. So this is this manifold over here is the configuration space. Once you have your configuration space, the cotangent bundle of this configuration space is your phase space. So when you have a Lagrangian, a second order Lagrangian, your phase space is always the cotangent bundle of something, and the moments are exactly what I've written here. Probably not tomorrow. I will have a slightly non-trivial example, because the obvious example is the P's and Q's, where the P's are basically the velocities. But if you have an external magnetic field, things become a bit more interesting. And so I will give an example with that. But I prefer to finish the abstract nonsense in a way before going to an example. So any cotangent bundle is a phase space. And if you want dynamically, the dynamical reason is because you can Lagrangians live on configuration spaces. And when you go and build the phase space from a Lagrangian, you're actually secretly accessing this cotangent bundle. Now, there is a crucial theorem which I want to discuss a bit in detail about symplectic spaces, which is Darboux theorem. So Darboux theorem says the following. Take a symplectic space. Then, locally, and I will come back to what this means in a second, because it's the most important word in the theorem, there exist coordinates, which I will denote q1, qn, p1, pn, such that omega in these coordinates can be written as as if it was a cotangent bundle. So these are called either canonical coordinates or Darboux coordinates. So what does locally mean? It means in an open neighborhood, of every point. So I haven't written it explicitly, because I will often use locally in this course, and this is the meaning I give to it. It's always about open neighborhood of points. Doesn't mean at one point. It means in open neighborhoods of points. So the reason why So in this corollary, just before going into the interesting stuff, is that the Liouville form is up to a sign which is conventional, is just dq1, dqn, dqp1, dqpn. So it's just the usual volume form. Now, the crucial thing about this theorem is that it should be compared to Riemannian geometry. So in a sense, what we're doing is the following. These Darboux coordinates are just the coordinates in which the symplectic form looks, well, it's not diagonal because it's antisymmetric, but it's the closest thing to diagonal, right? It's just this 1 minus 1 antidiagonal object. So it's a bit like the flat metric of Euclidean space. So one could say that in Riemannian geometry, you can always find coordinates in which are metric, and now locally, but let's keep in mind, looks like a flat metric. But there locally doesn't mean the same that I mean here. There it means it's a flat metric at one point up to first order. And then at second order, you have curvature corrections that kick in and destroy everything. Whereas here, What I'm saying is that this is true in an open neighborhood. So these symplectic geometries are way more rigid than Riemannian geometries. You have these straight coordinates, in a sense, that can be extended to open neighborhoods, not just at one point up to first order, but to open neighborhoods. So it's a finite, it's not an approximation, in a sense. Is they really look like this when you're close by. Is that clear in which way it's different from a similar statement in Riemannian mechanics, in Riemannian geometry? So the counterpart to this is that, so we can think of these spaces a bit like being be flat spaces in Riemannian geometry, because we say, oh, this is like, they can always be put into this form. But then we think about what are the isometries of a Riemannian flat space. The isometries of flat space are those diffeomorphisms that preserve the metric, right? And there are not many of them. In Minkowski, there are 10. So it's the Poincaré group, essentially. Whereas here, the analog of those transformations are what are symplectomorphisms. Which are diffeomorphisms such that omega is preserved. So written in coordinates, they are transformations that preserve this simple structure. So they are canonical transformations, if you want. And now the important point is that contrary to isometries, which give you a finite dimensional group, these objects are way, way bigger. It's an infinite dimensional group, essentially. OK? So fact So although it looks kind of similar to Riemannian geometry, it's quite different. So its study is very different than the study of Riemannian geometry. But superficially, it's just all about things that locally look like diagonal matrices in one case, and in this other case, anti-diagonal matrices. But that makes the whole difference. Now, the reason why one is getting all this rigidity, however, is this condition. So it's telling us that this is a strong condition that is kind of flattening things out. Okay. So it's not just about being anti-symmetric and non-degenerate. There's also the closeness that is crucial, that is kind of saying that things are so rigid. OK. Yes?
When you say neighborhood, something determines the size of that neighborhood.
I don't know. I don't know if there is a scale like curvature would be. Here, I think it's more of a topological issue rather than. So the point is this. So the module space for a phase space are these cotangent bundles. And there you can have a closed Q, but momentum space is always. Okay, let me give you an example. It's always infinite dimension. It's always flat. It's always a plane. So the simplest example of a symplectic space that is not a cotangent bundle is the sphere. So this is an interesting example. So P is a two-sphere, and omega is the area, 2-4. So in this case, it's clearly non-degenerate. And it's also clearly closed, because it's a top form, so it's closed trivially. So in coordinates, what is this this guy? And I've killed half of you to death with understanding why this is. You cannot write a potential, in fact, globally. So this is true that I could write cos theta d phi. Well, this is a different theta, of course, but a potential like this. But this potential is not well defined everywhere. It fails to be defined at the two poles. Or if I put 1 plus or minus just at one pole, and so on. So this is the Dirac string business. So in this case, this is definitely not the cotangent bundle of anything, because it's compact, whereas this is always non-compact. And this is a potential exists, so canonical coordinate exists. If you want, these are my p's, and this is my q. But, well, but you see, q is not even well-defined globally, because when you come back, it has a different value. So it's multivalued function. It's not a good coordinate. So these coordinates are good coordinates everywhere except on a meridian. But if you remove that meridian, then this thing looks like a cotangent bundle. But you have to remove that. So it's a topological issue, not more than a geometric one. Yes?
So the Ruf's theorem tells us that basically we also cannot build something like the Riemann tensor, because it would be like, it would be zero because of the reason that you said.
Yeah, I think there is no higher order. Like you define the curvature I would say there is no higher rank tensor that is interesting in this case, I think.
So I mean, I would for the mm-hmm. if we have a sphere or a plane or a hyperbola, we know that they are different. We can compute that they are different locally.
Yeah.
By looking at their
frequency. Exactly. Here locally, all symplectic manifolds look the same, because they all look like cotangent bundles locally. In fact, they all look like R to the 2n. In big open neighborhoods, not just in the tangent space approximation.
And even dimensions, because of this analogy that you gave earlier, uh-huh. I was just wondering, and even dimensions, if given a Riemannian manifold, can I always construct a symplectic manifold by taking the volume form induced from?
No. Well, you need the two form, the volume form, in two dimensions.
In even dimensions.
In even, so. A symplectic form is a two form. So if you are in four dimensions, the volume form would be a four form, so it doesn't help. But in 2D, this would work in any 2D. Okay. Like looping back in the last 5 minutes to where we started from, let's go back to, so we have given all these overview of symplectic geometry, but now let's go back to our Poisson bracket and Hamiltonian vector fields we started from. So first, I want to give a geometric interpretation of what the Poisson bracket is. It is a bivector. So it means that I can write it like this. And I put this wedge more to mean that the thing is anti-symmetric than anything else. So it's not; these are not forms. It's just to. So a bivector is not just a ranked, is an anti-symmetric, is a skew-symmetric rank 2 cotensor. I'm always confused about covectors and vectors. Rank to contravariant tensor. That's it. Now, the proposition that explains why I'm calling these things phase spaces is the following. And I will come back to this formula in a second. So if you're confused, like bear with me for a moment. Let P be symplectic, then P pi with pi ij at z defined as the inverse of my omega as a matrix is Poisson. And Poisson, well, I'm not sure all of you see if I write there. And Poisson requires three properties. It means that it is Q-symmetric. It means that it's a biderivation. And it satisfies Jacobi. So skew-symmetric is obvious. It just means that this guy, you know, the Poisson bracket is antisymmetric in the two entries. So that's what it means. A biderivation means that it satisfies some Leibniz rule in each of the entries. So this is GH plus GHF. So sorry, I did it the other way around. And this is obvious once you write it as a bivector. This is why this is a bivector, because a Poisson bracket satisfies these kind of Leibniz formulas in both of its entries, so it means that it must be of this form. Finally, the non-trivial guy, as always, is Jacobi. So the fact that we've seen that these two are obvious, the non-trivial one to prove is the Jacobi identity. And the Jacobi identity comes from property number two over there, from the closeness. So this is why one has to require that those things are closed. Otherwise, one would lose Jacobi, the Jacobi identity. I encourage you to prove this fact. It's a standard. It's standard, but it's instructive. Both in coordinates, you can use Darboux theorem, and it would be completely trivial. Or you can do it in, so using Darboux, this is obvious. But it's nicer to do it abstractly without introducing coordinates. Finally, I'll go here. I just give the last, then I'll keep it for next time. I don't want to go over. OK, I wanted to go back to the Hamiltonian, but that's where I will start from tomorrow.